Matt, we have a special episode tonight, this week. We have a special guest joining us, senior writer at The Athletic and co-author of the book Kingdom Quarterback. Rustin Dodd is joining us this week. Rustin, thanks for coming on the podcast.
No, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I heard about the book you wrote with Mark Dent a few months ago. I perused Kirkus reviews, and they had a early review of the book up, and I knew Matt's the big Chiefs fan, and I said, Matt, there's a book coming out in a couple of months about Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. And I was like, and it was kind of, he was like, oh, that's interesting. And I was like, yeah. And then fast forward to a couple of months, you graciously sent the book, we both read it, and as a lifelong Broncos fan, I'm probably not your like target audience for a Chiefs book about, you know, the greatness of Patrick Mahomes and the, it turns out to kind of like the history of Kansas City. But I think what you, for me personally, it highlighted a lot of things about what sports means to a town and sort of the complicated history towns often have with sports. But kind of getting into the book, how did you, because the book's not just about Patrick Mahomes, it's a kind of a detailed story of Kansas City, dating back almost like over 100 years. How did you guys settle on sort of the dual nature storytelling of the book? And sort of, did that start from the beginning, or is that something that came, you know, a couple months into sort of research and figuring out the book?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the book kind of, the origins of the book kind of started in 2020. So this is kind of the months after the Chiefs won their first Super Bowl over the 49ers. And you know, for background, so I grew up in a suburb of Kansas City called Overland Park. It's just, you know, big, massive suburb, you know, hundreds of thousands of people and big subdivisions and like pretty classic suburb. And Mark, my co-author, he did as well. And we're both mid to late 30s. So this is like the 1990s. This is kind of when we were growing up in Overland Park in Kansas City as a whole. And you know, when we were growing up, like maybe this was true of like all cities at the time, but like Kansas City had just sort of kind of fallen on hard times. The city had kind of been hollowed out. You know, the suburbs were like, were what they were, but like Kansas City just didn't really have, as a city, at least it didn't really have much going for it in the 90s. And then, you know, fast forward, I ended up working as a sports writer at the Kansas City Star in my 20s and early 30s for a long time. And so I was in Kansas City as it sort of kind of seemed to kind of revive and like come back. And this story was like true of a lot of American cities, I think, in like the 2000s and 2010s. You know, people were kind of moving back into cities and cities were kind of coming back. But Kansas City's story seemed very like specific. It really seemed to have this sort of comeback story that was going on. So anyway, so after the Chiefs won their first Super Bowl, and it just really seemed like Patrick Mahomes was sort of kind of destined to be the quarterback of his generation. Like if you watched his first couple of seasons, like, you know, as a Chiefs fan, it just seems sort of obvious. Like the Chiefs were going to probably win multiple Super Bowls and potentially be a kind of a dynasty. So long story short, Mark basically had the idea, you know, like, why don't we sort of explore a book about Kansas City and sort of its comeback, but, you know, kind of use Mahomes as sort of a character to kind of tell that story. And then, yeah, again, long story short, as we were sort of exploring how we would tell the story of Kansas City's comeback, we sort of realized we had to kind of tell the whole story of the city to sort of explain how it got to where it was. And then sort of as we were kind of, you know, figuring things out, we kind of realized that like really can't, and this is true of a lot of cities, but, you know, the story of Kansas City is kind of just the story of all American cities, or at least all a lot of Midwestern American cities. So that's kind of the, like the whole story of how the book came to be.
There's a prominent figure, J.C. Nichols, is kind of a very important, he's almost the kind of historical figure that it's probably the most important, I would say, kind of from the city of Kansas City. Was that a figure that you knew early on that you kind of wanted to have the story of Kansas City revolve around? Sort of, it's kind of, I think, like you said, a lot of American cities have a very kind of sad and tragic backstory for the last 100 years for a variety of reasons. Was he a figure that you knew early on that was going to be an important part of the book?
Yeah, I think so. And for a couple of reasons. So like, yeah, J.C. Nichols was sort of this prominent developer in Kansas City in the early 20th century. He sort of developed all these kind of affluent and then middle class neighborhoods, kind of was like the most prominent developer in terms of segregating the city kind of through restrictive covenants. And like that story is familiar in a lot of cities as well. But he also was really influential, like nationally beyond Kansas City. He just happened to be at the time, like this really nationally renowned developer whose sort of methods were adopted in other cities. And so J.C. Nichols was like, when I was growing up in the 90s, he was a known figure, but he was more known as sort of like the father of Kansas City, you know, like, or at least one of the fathers of Kansas City, is like the guy that kind of developed the city and made it nice. And like, it's a nice place to live. And it was because of J.C. Nichols. And then over the last 20 years, his kind of story has sort of been reconsidered as people kind of become more and more aware of sort of the methods he used and how, you know, he really was at the, you know, we get into this in the book, but it's always confusing. And part of the reason that we wanted to write about it was he was very prominent in sort of the national law, the creation of the Federal Homes Administration or Federal Housing Administration that eventually is where we get the idea of redlining. He was kind of part of that. And so this story kind of was becoming more and more known throughout Kansas City, but it was like one of those things where, you know, it's always kind of told in a few paragraphs and, you know, you get the broad strokes. And even as somebody who sort of kind of understood what happened, I was still kind of always just like, okay, I don't totally get this. Like, yes, I know what, like, you know, what these paragraphs say, but like, I'm still just a little unclear what happened here. So that was part of it, was that he had really kind of, his story had kind of been reconsidered over the last decade or so. But Mark and I, we just kind of wanted to like understand it better. And we thought maybe kind of by telling his whole story that maybe other people could kind of like, kind of finally understand it better as well. And this, we get into this in the book, but when there was a lot of protests happening in 2020, a lot of the energy in Kansas City was, you know, more locally directed at J.C. Nichols. Like he was a very, you know, prominent figure kind of like during that summer, as people kind of were kind of reconsidering, Kansas City's past.
Yeah. You know, what kind of struck me when you're talking about the Nichols part and how his kind of, plans for urban development, how to structure a city, and I guess I gather kind of subtly segregate it de facto, you know, and how it kind of spread to other cities. It's a weird sort of darker inverse, or it kind of mirrors the process of an NFL coach's tree, like how it kind of spreads and branches out in a weird way.
Yeah, I mean, totally. I mean, yeah. At least, you know, like, J.C. Nichols, like the interesting thing about Kansas City is you always think of, you know, suburban subdivisions. But if you've ever been to Kansas City, like there are suburban subdivisions in Kansas City proper, in part because he just sort of, and he kind of developed the idea of what a suburban subdivision should look like. Like the streets should be curved, and like there should be, you know, driveways and lawns, and like, you know, the houses should be set back from the, you know, the curb, not like, you know, built like row homes, or, you know, like all these ideas about housing. And but, you know, all like this stuff was happening all across the country. It wasn't just like, oh, this came from one developer in Kansas City, but he just happened to be so good at developing these neighborhoods that, you know, developers across the country would kind of like come to Kansas City and kind of look at the neighborhoods and kind of basically kind of copy his ideas. So yeah, it is interesting how those like sort of ideas kind of move throughout, you know, the country at the time.
Yeah. And one of the kind of the later chapter that I thought was fascinating, when you're talking about Mahomes and he's kind of settled into Kansas City, like he's going to be the future quarterback, he's already Pro Bowler, is he moves into a home in sort of one of these J.C. Nichols developments, correctly? And it's, there's not so much in the book, is there's not so much like, oh, he's in a Nichols, you know, neighborhood. This is kind of a big story. It's his address was released, and that was kind of like the invasion of privacy. But I thought when those two stories melded, I was like, oh, that's fascinating. Like, you would never have, like, if you didn't tell the backstory of Kansas City, him moving into this neighborhood, it would just be like, oh, it's a nice neighborhood. And kind of the book tells, oh, that wasn't, you know, these racial covenants. And the book does a great job of showing how, like, they did this sinister thing where it was like self perpetuating. You said, like, it was banned, like, the federal government said that you can't do this, but these things just kind of kept staying on the books for, you know, decade after decade. And it was just like kind of fascinating story about how something can kind of, you know, kind of hang around where it's just like, I don't know. It was great reporting by you and Mark on that aspect of Kansas City, I thought. So.
No, thank you. Yeah. I mean, we sort of tell the story in the book, but yeah, like, so there were always like covenants with homes in the early 20th century. And they could be about anything. Like, so it's like, you know, there's rules about what you can do as a homeowner, right? Like, you know, the various things and like, but the covenants used to, like, once a home would be sold once and then be sold again. And the covenants would be kind of be, you know, like they would not follow each individual homeowner. But Nichols realized, like, that was bad for neighborhoods, at least in his opinion, because he wanted more control over a neighborhood so he could kind of keep the neighborhood nice or the, you know, property values high. So he realized that he needed to, you know, like, methods in order to keep the, you know, covenants self-perpetuating, is the way he described it and the way the words you used. And so, yeah, he would create homeowners associations. You know, he wasn't the first one to, you know, create a homeowners association, but he was very, like, saw the value in them. And he would tie the covenants into basically that they would last for 20 years, but they would only be reversed if, you know, 80% of the homeowners association voted against it. And then obviously one of the covenants that, you know, were always part of his subdivisions were race, right? So, you know, no Black people could live in that neighborhood. So it'd be like one of, you know, seven or eight main covenants that it would go with a house. But yeah, so, it's a tragic story, but, and it's, you know, true in most cities, but these covenants eventually became illegal and unenforceable by law, but they never really came off the books. So I think the Supreme Court ruling was in 1948. So at that point they were, and actually they were even illegal a little bit before. But yeah, so essentially they stayed on the books for, you know, decades and decades. They were unenforceable, but, you know, if you look at any city in the Midwest and really any city in the country, you still see these large patterns of segregation. And that's more or less from, you know, the, you know, not just J.C. Nichols, but from, you know, developers like him, you know, kind of across the country.
Knowing Matt and sort of like Chiefs fans, just from knowing Matt, and from we've talked about the Chiefs from the 90s, like when the Broncos were good and I had Elway, and Matt's always, since he's got Mahomes, I'm always like, why aren't you more confident in your team? And I feel like he's like gun shy about being confident. He's nodding in his head. I'm like, why? You have the best quarterback. Like, what is happening here? Can you talk about like what it was like to be a Chiefs fan growing up in the like 90s and what sort of the city, like, was it always like a, you had good teams, but it always felt like something like would just not click, or you would, you know, miss a kick or something like that. What was kind of like the collective Chiefs fandom like in the 90s into 2000 before Mahomes, I guess?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. One is that when I was researching this book and just kind of looking back at that period with hindsight and like distance, it's like, I remember the Chiefs and Broncos being like fairly competitive in the, you know, the mid, you know, 90s, like, you know, the Chiefs would go into Mile High and win. And then, you know, like there was that game where Pete Stoyanovich had the, you know, the famous field goal at the very end and they won. And, you know, obviously the Broncos won the two Super Bowls, but even though in one of those seasons, you know, the Chiefs went into the playoffs as the number one seed and the Broncos beat them at Arrowhead. And so, like, I remember that rivalry feeling like fairly even. Yet if you actually look from basically like the mid 1980s, basically Elway to Mahomes, it's not even at all. Like the numbers are kind of staggering, you know, the how many games the Broncos won between like Elway and Mahomes. So that was like shocking to just like look at those numbers. But no, I mean, the existence of being a Chiefs fan was, it was strange because the franchise had sort of come back in the early 90s under Marty Schottenheimer. And so in the city just kind of came alive for them in this way that was kind of, it was cool and kind of just different and unprecedented. I mean, the city just kind of fell in love with the Chiefs in the early 90s. And the teams were, you know, usually in the playoffs and they were usually competitive, but they won. I mean, they had this long losing streak in the postseason, which then be kind of, you know, we kind of romanticize it now, and kind of all the hardships, but also like they just didn't have a quarterback, right? So like they just, they played this style of kind of smash mouth Marty ball, you know, with great defenses, but they never had a quarterback. And, you know, they traded for Joe Montana, sort of worked. You know, they kept trading for a series of backup quarterbacks, you know, Steve Bono, Elvis Gerback, and then on to Trent Green, who was probably like the best of that group. Mm-hmm. You know, they have Rich Gannon for a little while, you know, but they pick Elvis Gerback over him. And, you know, even just like, you know, the names like Gerback and Bono and, you know, on down the list, Steve DeBerg. I mean, these are the guys that were supposed to, you know, win a Super Bowl. And it's like, well, of course they never won a Super Bowl, you know, with these quarterbacks. And I guess maybe, you know, I also think maybe in the 1990s that, and we sort of trace the history of the quarterback position a little bit in the book, but maybe in the 90s, we as football fans didn't even quite realize the importance of the quarterback position the way we do now. I mean, I think people did, right? Like they knew who the best quarterbacks were. It was Elway and Montana and, you know, like franchise quarterbacks won Super Bowls, but I don't know. Now it just seems like you have to have, you know, one of two or three or four guys to even have a chance. And I don't know if we looked at football like that, maybe in the same way in the 90s, or maybe I just was a kid and not totally, yeah, you know, up on football at the time.
Yeah. Well, I remember we would always have a really good running back, like a top five running back, pretty good defense. And yeah, it just wouldn't work out in the playoffs. Have you heard the thing where the 90s Chiefs are kind of like the Tennessee Titans now?
Yeah, I mean, that's the style of football that they play. And they always had great offensive linemen, great offensive lines. You know, Marty Schottenheimer he's one of the most successful regular season coaches, you know, in NFL history. Yep. But yeah, the style maybe is not the style that is what can win postseason.
You get the one seed and you just lose that first playoff game.
Yeah.
Arguably the best running back in the game and an all right quarterback. It's kind of,
I don't know if this is fair, but I was going through 90s Chiefs quarterbacks and I just thought, like, some of them are very like good, like Montana, this past prime Montana, but I always, the word I came up with, they're all kind of dorky. They're not very cool. And like, what you have now is the coolest quarterback who does the coolest throws, no look passes, all this stuff. It's like, for me, Elway was cool. The Elvis Gerback was very like mechanical. I guess maybe Trent, I don't know. It just felt like.
No, well, they were all kind of the same. Yeah. You know, Steve Bono and Trent Green was had better numbers and had good offenses, but they were all kind of just statuesque kind of guys with, you know, nice hair and, you know, not much mobility. And that was sort of the style. I mean, there's funny stories about all of them. You know, Steve Bono came from San Francisco and he got in a lot of hot water because he told a reporter for Sports Illustrated that there were no good restaurants in Kansas City. And that was the biggest adjustment that he had coming from San Francisco to Kansas City, was that he couldn't find a good place to eat. You know, we tell the story in like two sentences in the book. And I wish we could write an entire chapter about this story, but there's, you know, Elvis Gerback was selected as the sexiest athlete alive in like 1997 or 1998. You know, fact check me on the year. And at the time, you know, it was a little curious, like, Elvis Gerback, really? And it turns out, and this has now been reported and is true, that they actually were trying to pick Rich Gannon, but there was confusion at People Magazine. Because of who was the starting quarterback and who was not.
Yeah.
And somebody thought they were like, oh, it's the quarterback. We're picking the quarterback of the Chiefs. They didn't realize that one of the editors there had actually seen a photo of Rich Gannon, and that's who they were trying to pick. And in fact, there's even a funny story that one of the PR people from the Chiefs at the time went and told Marty Schottenheimer that People Magazine had picked Elvis Gerback as the sexiest athlete alive that year. And Marty, according to this PR guy, said, oh, you mean Gannon? And they're like, no, they picked Elvis. So yeah, and it, a bit, yeah, just like a kind of a comedy of errors involving the quarterbacks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and so Peter, that's why I keep waiting for the other shoe to drop. Despite all the success, I'm always kind of like, okay, something's gonna just try to play it cool, because I've seen how bad it can go.
See, I have a theory, and I want to run it by you, because I think you've never had a quarterback, like, let's say the Detroit Lions. You're always hoping that you somehow like cobbled together a team and be good in defense and running back and something like that. But once you get a quarterback, like a Mahomes or an Elway or like a Peyton Manning, I think your expectations going forward are always like, no, we need that. So I don't know. I think your expectations will go up. Like, I would imagine Mahomes will be there for like the next 5-10 years or something like that. But I was wondering, do you think the cities, now that they've seen success, do you think that like will expect more from the Chiefs going forward? Or is it just like, are they happy that this once in a lifetime generational talent is there? And it's like, we're good. We're winning Super Bowls. But because I have a feeling like once you get to success, I don't think you're like, okay with, well, let's have Brody Croyle out there as our quarterback.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think during the Mahomes era, there's two things happening at once. There's a general sense of just joy and happiness that the city has never experienced before. And I think people understand just sort of how rare that is. And there's also you immediately take it for granted. And that you expect to win the Super Bowl every year. And I think those two things are like true at the same time. And even individual people can hold those same thoughts in their mind, like at the same time, without even realizing that they're kind of contradictory. I mean, that's kind of what sports fandom is all about, is just sort of thinking irrationally. So, I think that's just kind of the feeling right now, whereas like, I think everybody totally understands how rare this moment is, and also is, you know, expects to go 16-1 and win the Super Bowl this year. And doesn't, you know, realize that they're kind of taking things for granted a little bit.
Yeah. I think we'll look back and realize just how great it was. But in the moment, I think I see, you know, people on the it's Twitter, so whatever. But yeah, a lot of Chiefs fans on Twitter were dumping on Veach this offseason because of the wide receiver room. And it's like, can we just give the guy some credit for taking, you know, 10 rookies to the Super Bowl last year and trust him with the wide receivers? You know?
Yeah.
You mentioned Veach, and the book goes into sort of his rise, and it's kind of like an amazing, I didn't know the backstory at all. To be honest, I don't follow the Chiefs front office that closely, shockingly. So I didn't know where exactly, you know, he's the GM, correct, right now for the Chiefs. It feels like the Chiefs are like, quote unquote, one of those like smart teams. You know, you see it in like basketball, the Warriors are their smart team. Where like, is that an accurate sense that they're kind of doing things the right? There seem to be, they have to pay Mahomes a lot of money, but they seem to still be building a team. Like, obviously they won the Super Bowl last year, but is there a sense that they are considered like a smart team and what they're doing, the people in the front office are kind of, you know, doing things the right way?
I think having Steph Curry or Patrick Mahomes allows, you know, people to portray you as a smart team. I think that they are a more progressive, I guess, to use that word, in like a football standpoint. We don't get into this in the book very much, but you know, one of the reasons that Brett Veach was hired was that John Dorsey, his predecessor, who was a great evaluator of talent, was not as great with the salary cap. And I think that's so, I think that's like where you would see maybe where the Chiefs, you know, smarts or like whatever, you know, football version of smarts is the way they've maybe sort of handled the cap or handled, you know, signing Patrick Mahomes, you know, to like this long contract that immediately was more or less team friendly. And so they've made some nice moves just that way. But no, I mean, Brett Veach's story is fascinating. I mean, he was a college football player at Delaware who then went into kind of college administration as a grad student, and then started working sort of as a summer intern for the Philadelphia Eagles. And, you know, he's still a young guy, but he's really was not a full-time NFL kind of employee until like the late 2000s. So we're talking only 13 or 14 years ago that he was, Andy Reid's, you know, personal assistant with the Philadelphia Eagles. So his rise has been, you know, very swift. But, you know, it's also just kind of an incredible story. And we kind of tell the story of how he, among, you know, other people, but he was one of the, you know, the foremost kind of Mahomes supporters or Mahomes proselytizers or, you know, however you want to describe it in terms of them getting him in the draft. So they're, I think, you know, Brett Veach and Mahomes will always be connected in that way. Who knows how long Brett Veach will be the GM, but even, you know, beyond that, they'll think that story will sort of live on forever.
Yeah, it was a good call. It was a good move.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you both, Matt, I don't think I've ever asked you this question. And I remember because the first game Mahomes played or started was against the Broncos. And I remember watching that game. They're like, this is a problem. This is okay. This is I think it was the last game of the season, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's why.
Was that this like, were you sold at that point? Or is it like, this is different? Or when was the moment where you both were like, okay, we're set? Like, this is there. I've never had a quarterback like this in my life, rooting for a quarterback like this in my life. Was there a specific game, throw, story that kind of sold you on the Mahomes being the GOAT, so to speak?
We'll go ahead.
No, you go first. You go first.
Well, I was thinking the first little tingling in the back of my head was there's a preseason game against the Titans, I think. And I think you guys mentioned it in the book, actually, where he made this crazy throw across his body preseason that year. And then there's a clip on YouTube you can see, and they cut to Alex Smith and his face kind of like drops. Like he kind of realizes like this guy might take my job here soon. So it was preseason. I think me and a lot of other fans kind of just had the little like, oh man, if this works in the regular season, this might be something.
Yeah. So, well, that throw is also, it's in the book, and it was, you know, the first time I think Chiefs fans saw him, you know, you've seen all these wild highlights from Texas Tech. And that was the first throw where you were like, that, you know, that's incredible. And then he made a couple of similar plays against the Broncos in the last game of the season. They come back and win that game. But I think one thing that if you actually, you know, like without revisionist history, if you just go back the next season, he replaces Alex Smith. And I still think that the idea among Chiefs fans or amongst people in Kansas City was that Patrick Mahomes was going to be much closer to Brett Favre, that he had this incredible arm. He was going to make all these highlight throws and he was going to do all this incredible stuff, but that he was also going to do a lot of dumb stuff too. He was going to throw a lot of picks. He was going to be like, you know, a gunslinger. And that was, I think, the idea going into the next season was like, okay, this guy's not going to be Alex Smith. He's not going to be a game manager. He's going to make plays. He's going to be incredibly exciting, but the Chiefs might actually be worse for a while because he's going to make a lot of mistakes. And that ended up not being the case at all. He had all of the highlight plays, and also he didn't make any mistakes. And he kind of, I mean, threw 50 touchdowns his first year starting, and really didn't, I think he had fact check me on this. I think he had 10 interceptions for the year. And I think it was like 50 and 10, although I should know that off the top of my head. And then the next year he had even fewer interceptions. And it was his ability to protect the ball and his accuracy and just like everything was already there. I mean, they were so good out of the gate in 2018. I mean, he exploded onto the scene, and it was almost like, I remember I had a friend who, you know, he started calling him Neo, because he was like, this guy is the one. And that always kind of stuck with me because it really kind of felt like that. it was like, this guy is, you know, like immediately the greatest quarterback you've ever seen. And that sounds like, you know, typical sports hyperbole. Yet it, if you were there in the moment, it felt like true to life.
Yeah,
I didn't expect that much success right out the gate. Like, this guy will be really good in a year or two, and, you know, we'll go from there. I didn't expect 5 AFC championships games in a row, you know.
I didn't realize the Broncos had never beaten him. He's 11-0 against the Broncos. Yeah. The Chiefs have won 15 straight. I was like, I knew they have a winning streak, but I was like, let me double check it's like 15 games. I'm like, ugh. So reliving all these great Mahomes things, it's fun. I was like, Elway was great in the 90s, but no. Matt, do you have a question? I lost my train of thought.
No, I thought the way you guys structured the book was really well done. And I thought it kind of like dwelt on some interesting kind of facts of modern life. For the listener, it's kind of a mix. It's the history of Kansas City interwoven with the story of Patrick Mahomes and his rise from kind of a three-sport talented high school athlete to the best quarterback playing right now. It's really well done. I just like the idea you guys kind of dwell on, and it's an interesting concept of what it means to a city to have somebody like that. You know, you're almost like the prince or a king of a city when you're doing really well. That's interesting.
No, well, thanks for saying that. And, you know, I guess I think people who like or are interested in stories about cities, or people who are interested in stories about football, I think, you know, maybe that's sort of, people have to sort of buy into, or at least be into reading kind of both of those things. But I always kind of thought, even when we were sort of finishing the book, but then sort of like proofreading it and kind of putting the final touches on it, that having these two stories sort of at once, it almost makes the book kind of go by faster. I don't know if you guys agree with that. Maybe if you're bored with one part, you know, like maybe it goes by slow or whatever, but there's something about, you know, reading 20 pages about Patrick Mahomes and then, you know, getting a 15-page break about something totally different, where it doesn't feel as repetitive, or it doesn't feel as, you know, like it never quite gets boring, I guess. I don't know if you guys agree with that. I mean, maybe I'm not the one who should be judging my own book, but but I there's something about it where it just, even we were kind of reading it, you know, just to kind of proofread it and stuff, it goes by fairly quickly.
It's good. Yeah, you sent us the book what, like a week or two ago, and for the interview I was planning on getting it going so I'd have some good questions and get the gist, you know, but we'd finish it later. Like, we're both done. Yeah. it's a good book. We both finished it really quick. So yeah, it works.
That's right. I thought it was a fascinating quote by Clark Hunt near the end of the book, where he says, like, Patrick Mahomes is probably the most important figure in Kansas City. And, you know, should that be the case? He's just a sports player? You know, probably not, but he is. And I think that's an interesting quote in the dynamics of, like, as you have told this whole backstory of the city. And it's like, yeah, he probably shouldn't be the most important person, like, in, like, a perfect world. But, like, the reality is, like, he is. But he seems to, like, kind of, you go through the history of the city, it seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, the city's always tried, from like an appearance standpoint, to try to improve itself. Like, even from like the World War I monument, like they wanted to have some like importance to it, like not be a flyover city. So I guess like Mahomes being this like figurehead for not just like the NFL, but like, you know, the larger, you know, sports in general. I think it's an interesting dynamic of sort of how this city can kind of keep moving forward, because it does sound like there's progress, but there's still progress to be made. And there's sort of a, you know, you have to confront past, you know, mistakes and like, and things of that nature. So I think it's, the book does a great job of sort of, there's two stories that seemingly are going in, you know, but they do cross, and it's this kind of, you get a fuller story of both the city and the team, I think. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's a familiar story to a lot of people, you know, no matter where, you know, if you are from Denver, but you grew up, I mean, Denver, you know, has kind of transcended its status, but I'm sure, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, people have a different idea of what Denver felt like back then. But anyway, I guess my point is, like, I think everybody sort of kind of feels like what it's like to be some place that doesn't really feel that important. And Kansas City, that is sort of the eternal thing of being from there. And it's interesting because, you know, they've had professional sports teams, which is this sort of status symbol for cities, at least like modern America. And they've had them since, you know, the mid 50s. So it's not as if Kansas City was, you know, like this nowhere, nothing town. But in terms of like, you know, real true American cities, it's always just sort of felt a little bit overlooked. And that sort of, you know, mindset has always sort of been there. People have always been sort of striving to sort of make it feel more cosmopolitan or more important. It had, you know, had this reputation as sort of this cow town where there were literally like stockyards where, you know, thousands and thousands of cattle were being, you know, put into like trains and sent around the country. And, you know, so it had this like kind of country cow town reputation for decades. And yeah, it's always just kind of felt like it's trying to get up to that next place, like that next rung on the ladder. And I think that's, you know, it's, if whether you, I think a lot of people can sort of relate to that, where you know, Paul Rudd, he had this like line about Kansas City. He's got a bunch of them. He's from there, and he's featured in the book a little bit. But he, you know, had this line about like how it might be actually kind of healthy to kind of grow up in a place where you realize it's not that important. And you sort of, and maybe it's good for you. And at least he thought that. And anyways, I'm kind of rambling now, but I think the story of Kansas City is just of a place that's kind of questioning its place in the world and like whether or not it really matters. And I think, I don't know, I think a lot of people, you know, no matter where you're from, can kind of relate to that idea a little bit.
Sure. Just being comfortable in their own skin, so to speak, and not sort of judging. Is that kind of a way of looking at it? Sort of being okay with who they are? And
yeah, I think it's sort of, you know, just being kind of, you know, the way I always describe Kansas Cityans, it's sort of interesting. It's like they are the most intensely proud people of where they are from. And like the most, like they want to share, you know, what makes Kansas City special with everybody else. They want to tell people all about it. They think nobody knows anything about Kansas City, so they want to explain it to people. Like they are so proud of where they are from. And yet they have like sort of this like, you know, eternal like kind of self-doubt that nobody else will ever actually see it that way. And, you know, nobody will like that, like, you know, people, you know, don't actually realize that where they live is like this really cool city with all this stuff going on. And so these kind of two things happening at once. And so I think, you know, you get a little bit of this in a lot of different cities, and I'm sure it's similar in Buffalo or Cleveland or, you know, Milwaukee, or, you know, I'm sure that the same kind of themes exist. But it's funny just how much people love being from Kansas City and yet have this little chip on their shoulder about being from there. And I think that's just kind of always kind of been the story.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I like the Hemingway quote that's towards the beginning of the book. Kansas City used to be Constantinople. It's hard to believe now, but
yeah. Well, and I mean, we kind of write about it in the book, but like, you know, Kansas City in the 1880s and 90s, and then into early 20th century was, I mean, it was more or less like New Orleans. I mean, that was kind of the entire purpose of the town, was to be sort of just a party town where people could kind of find everything. And I mean, you know, gambling, prostitution, like anything, it was all there, and it was all more or less right out in the open. You know, there's other cities like that, but it was, you know, the kind of place where you would go to, you know, find a row of, you know, bars like Bourbon Street or whatever, and just, and have a good time.
Yeah. And I like you guys kind of deal with the arc of that, like from that type of city, you know, notorious, to just kind of a suburb, you know, a Midwestern suburban town with kind of mediocre sports teams. And now is kind of like, are we, you know, on the rise? Is it something different? Is it something to stand out? You know, the best quarterback in the world plays there. Our team's exciting again. What's going to, you know.
I have a silly question about Kansas City, because if you're from Kansas City, do you used to say, I'm from Kansas City? Do you not say, oh, I'm from Kansas? Or if you live on the Missouri side, you say, I'm from Missouri? Like, if you live in Denver, let's say, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm from, like, there's that interesting dynamic, which I just, you kind of delve into it at the beginning of the book, like, it's the founding of the city is kind of a strange thing. Like, do you just say I'm from Kansas City, or do you just, like, if you're from one side or the other, does it matter? Like,
it's a really interesting question for this reason, that I think most people, whether or not they're from the suburbs or from whatever part, you know, on the Kansas side or the Missouri side, well, if you ask them, if they tell you where they're from, they will say Kansas City. The idea being, like, there's kind of this greater Kansas City that exists, where, you know, like Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas, suburbs, everybody will say Kansas City. Now, this might be controversial if you're actually from Kansas City, but it's also kind of maybe because of the size of the place, where it just feels like one kind of giant town that is existing here, where, you know, like, I think if you're from like the northern suburbs of Chicago or like the southern outskirts, I mean, like, the Chicagoland area is so massive that I think if you lived in the suburb of Chicago and said you were from Chicago, people would take offense to that, or be like, well, you're not actually from Chicago, you know, you're from the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And yet in Kansas City, it's such a smaller place, relatively speaking, you know, to most cities, that I think, you know, like, if you ask Paul Rudd grew up in Overland Park, where I'm from, and also this neighboring suburb called Lenexa. If you ask Paul Rudd where he's from, he might say, I grew up in Kansas, but I think he would more likely say, I grew up in Kansas City, which is technically not accurate, but like, that would be how people would describe like where they're from.
Yeah, I think it counts. I think people like you and people from the outside are more fascinated with the, oh, it's a city in two states, than people from the area. Because there's not a border check. You can just keep driving.
I've been to Kansas City. I had a great time in Kansas City. It was, you know, going to the Power and Light District. This would have been probably like 10, 15 years ago. Got some barbecue, great barbecue. But no, because in my mind, I'm always like, Missouri claims St. Louis and Kansas claims Kansas City. But that's just in my head. But anyway, it's a fascinating, you know, story of how it's founded. So, kind of end on this. What are your predictions for the Chiefs upcoming season going forward? Do you think that the success continues? I don't really see any reason, that, you know, knock on wood for you guys, but, you know, as a Broncos fan, I would like to, you know, maybe Russell Wilson become good again. I don't know. Does the kind of success continue, or, as Kansas City fans, are you a little wary, like Matt is, that, you know, there's trouble around the corner, so to speak?
Well, I have two ways to answer that. One, in the very like short term, I mean, there are some questions with the Chiefs this year. I mean, Chris Jones is still holding out. I
Kelsey
mean,
just
you,
got kind of hurt, like,
yeah,
today to
he's
this guy.
Travis Kelce seems to be more or less fine, by all reports, but he's still injuries can happen, like, things can happen. Big picture wise, though, I actually, and I was doing another interview earlier today, and I actually think the Chiefs are entering maybe kind of the prime peak years of the Mahomes era. Because if you look at, they've won two Super Bowls in his years, 5 years as a starter, and during that time, they haven't had a top 10 defense. And they're one of the first teams that's really won multiple Super Bowls without, a real like consistent top 10 defense. And they've mostly, at least since Mahomes has been there, they mostly have had most of their resources allocated to the offensive side. They've had really good receivers and, good offensive linemen, and, they've really spent a lot of money on the offensive side of the ball. They have, the core of a young defense that, if things break right, could be a, I mean, not, like the best defense in the NFL or anything like that, but a top 10 defense for the next 2 to 3 years. So this may be kind of entering the phase where the offense and defense are both, top five, top 10 caliber. So you might actually, I think it's possible that the Chiefs' best teams of the Mahomes era could be over the next 2, 3, 4 seasons. Are they going to win the Super Bowl this year? Who knows? There'll be a bunch of coin flip games in January that will determine that. But I do think that if I was a betting person, I would bet that the Chiefs win one of the next three Super Bowls, and I would feel pretty confident in that bet, actually.
All right, Matt, I'm gonna remember this. So next time they lose a close game and you're down and you're, am I like, Russell Dodd was on our podcast and he was very positive. I'm like, you know, we draft picks we traded away from Russell Wilson, Matt. It can get worse. Let me tell you that much. No.
That's fine. Hey, do you have time for just three rapid fire inside baseball Kansas City questions?
Sure.
All right. Game 7 of the 2014 World Series, should they have sent Alex Gordon home?
No. I mean, he would have been thrown out by 20 feet, and it probably would have looked ridiculous. I guess there's like, I don't know what the odds would be, but like maybe there's 7% chance that the throw is wild or something like that, or it's, not fielded properly. But I think he would have been out by so much that it would have looked almost comical.
I think you're in retrospect, it would have been one of the more entertaining endings to a World Series ever. But yeah, the narrative would have been Salvi was coming up and he homered off Bumgarner in game one. So why? But still, if we hadn't won the next year, that would have been maybe my top like sports heartbreak. That game seven, the 2014. That was rough.
Yeah, I mean, it at the time it seemed like that it had been such a almost, fluke is not the right word, but it almost seemed that way at the time, and it just seemed like, well, the Royals will never be back in the World Series again, and that ended up being wildly wrong. They were back in the next year, but it definitely kind of seemed that way in 2014.
Oh man, that was rough. Hey, so if they move the stadium, Royal Stadium downtown, what happens to Arrowhead?
Well, I'm following along like any other fan, so this I don't have any great insider information on this, but it seems like the Chiefs want to stay at the general, location of where Arrowhead is, and it seems like the number one thing is that they want to stay in Arrowhead. So they would theoretically do a lot of remodeling of Arrowhead and maybe some other stuff around the sports complex where both stadiums are. But I think like there's like a 50 to 60% chance that the Chiefs remodel Arrowhead and that's the home of the Chiefs for another 30 or 40 years. And then there's probably other smaller chances that they just build an entirely new stadium on the site of maybe where Kauffman Stadium is or somewhere else in that parking lot. And then maybe even a smaller percentage chance that they, you know, end up somewhere else, like, you know, on the Kansas side somewhere or some other site location. But I think it's, by all accounts, Clark Hunt, the Chiefs owner, wants to stay in Arrowhead if it's possible. So they're probably just looking at some sort of expensive, you know, big renovation there.
Cool. That little Taco Bell on the corner will be very happy about that. And what odds of Kansas City getting an NBA team in the next 10 years?
I'm thinking of that too, actually.
Where are we on the list?
I'm not very high on this. I question whether or not Kansas City could support another professional team. The old story in Kansas City is not only are they, you know, population wise right around like the 30th biggest market in the country or so. So it, you know, supporting two teams plus, you know, an MLS team, that's a lot. Plus, you know, college basketball means a lot in that, in Kansas City. So you have that. And also they don't really have the corporate dollars that some towns have. You know, like they have some, you know, Fortune 500 companies and, you know, some, you know, big kind of companies in town, but they don't necessarily have the corporate money that can really support like an NBA team across 82 games. That's always been the thing. But I don't know. I mean, if you look at the markets that could get an NBA team, there's Seattle, there's Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And then if you start good, so that's, you know, 30, they would be at like 32 markets there, which I don't know if they're going beyond that. But like, if you start looking at where else could an NBA team go, there aren't that many, you know, other answers. So, you know, Kansas City is pretty close to, like, if you're just looking for a next, you know, reasonable market. So I guess, I don't know if this makes sense, but like, I don't think it's happening, but it's not as far-fetched as, I guess, you know, if you're looking for markets, you know, there's only so many, out there. So I guess it could, you know, if Kansas City continues to grow and has some momentum, you know, maybe things change in 10 or 12 years.
That's a good point. Sustaining a whole regular season. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
Well, Rustin, this has been an absolute pleasure talking to you about, I mean, I can't, you know, as a Broncos fan, this is about as much fun I can, you know, have talking about the greatness of Patrick Mahomes. But the book is fantastic. Kingdom Quarterback is the title. It's out now. Can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast and talking about it.
No, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed this. It's been fun.
All right.